I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on KOOP, your community radio station, cooperatively run in Austin, Texas. We are also rebroadcast every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on WFTE-FM in Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. And we go out all over the place on the World Wide Web. So welcome to RAG Radio. RAG Radio is produced in the studios of Co-op in Austin in coordination and association with the RAG blog. That's the ragblog.blogspot.com and the New Journalism Project. We again want to thank Carry On and the Uranium Savages for honoring us with the 2011 Eddie Award for Best Radio Personality. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, all of our shows, we want to remind you, are up after broadcast, or about a day after broadcast. The podcasts are up on the Internet Archive, and you can go search Internet. You can go to Internet Archive and search RAG Radio, and you can find all of the shows we've ever done. All right, RAGRadio at KOOP.org. That's our email address. Bernadine Dorn grew up near Milwaukee. She was a high school cheerleader, member of the National Honor Society, and editor of her school newspaper. Later, she would be on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Now, Bernadine Dorn is a respected scholar, an activist, academic, child advocate, clinical associate professor at Northwestern University School of Law. She's the founding director of the Children and Family Justice Center. Bernadine Dorn was a national leader of SDS and the Weather Underground and was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list for over a decade. Dorn writes and lectures on war and peace, racism and justice, reconciliation and restorative justice, children in conflict with the law, human rights, torture, and family violence. Jonah Raskin, our mutual dear friend, wrote a terrific article and did an interview with Bernadine in the current issue of the RAG blog. And in his introduction to the interview, Jonah wrote, "Who doesn't have a reaction to the name and the reputation of Bernadine Dorn? Is there anyone over the age of 60 who doesn't remember her role at the outrageous Days of Rage demonstrations, her picture on FBI wanted posters, or her dramatic surrender to law enforcement officials in Chicago after a decade as a fugitive? To former members of SDS, anti-war activists, Yippies, Black Panthers, White Panthers, women's liberationists, along with students and scholars of Weatherman and the Weather Underground, she probably needs no introduction." Jonah goes on to say, "Born in 1942 and a diligent student at the University of Chicago, she attended law school there and in the late 1960s, quote, stepped out of the role of the good girl, as she once put it. She has never really stepped back into it again, though she's been a wife, a mother, and a professional woman for more years than she was a street-fighting woman." Jonah said, "I don't know any other woman of her generation who has been as controversial, as optimistic and hopeful, and as committed to what I'd have to call political struggle as Bernadine Dorn." He also mentions that Bernadine Dorn is on the cusp of her 70th birthday. Bernadine Dorn, welcome to RAG Radio. It's been a while.
Hi, Thorne. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I like it that several of those sentences made you laugh.
Oh, it all has to make us laugh, doesn't it? It's great to talk to you. We've, of course, for those of you who don't know, and I doubt there are many of you who don't know, Bernadine is married to Bill Ayers and has been for how long? How long have you guys been together?
Oh, you know, we don't count from when we were married because that was years later, but 40 years. We've been together 40 years.
40 years. And, of course, we've seen Bill here in Austin a couple of times, and he's been on RAG Radio twice, but it's great now to have you on.
Good. I can't wait to come down.
Well, we're waiting for you.
Good.
Okay. Here's my first question. It's okay. You're on the, as I'm not revealing this because Jonah already did. You're on the cusp of your 70th birthday. Looking back at this point in time, looking back to those years that were full of energy, excitement, hope, struggle, and then looking at what's going on in this country right now, how do you feel? Of course, we were then. It was an empire in its full glory. Now we're an empire in decline. How do you look now back at that time and what's happening now?
Well, I try to live in the present, so I'm most interested in what's going on now. I think for all of us old-timers, you know, our job is out there listening and supporting the kids who are in motion. But I, you know, of course I look back at it, and one of the things that's striking is that, as you just pointed out, we really were living in the fat of the land, in the high point of U.S. domination and wealth, and, you know, relative, of course, it was never even, comfort. It didn't seem that way to us at the time. We, you know, hated what we were being prepared to do, really, to take over the reins of empire. And we did see the Vietnam War and the Black Liberation Movement, I think, as a turning point in U.S. power. But I think you're quite right to look now and see that now we're in the decline, whether it's a slow, miserable decline or a precipitous decline, yeah, right, of relative power in the world. It's quite a different thing. But I'm really excited about the moment that we're in.
Okay, we emerged, and I think we sort of were involved in the struggle somewhat around the same time. Our generation emerged from a period of kind of deep sleep, and it was like an incredible sort of awakening and sort of emerging of a new sense of life and possibility. Do you see parallels with what's going on now with young people, especially now with the Occupy Wall Street movement? Maybe this generation is not exactly emerging from a sleep as much as some of us were writing them off as being sort of cynical and self-centered and chained to economic problems technological devices and whatever. What do you think about what's going on right now?
James Baldwin said, you know, the impossible is the least that one can demand. I think that, you know, that's what we're seeing. And it's exhilarating to be at, I've been at only Occupy New York, Wall Street in New York, and at Occupy Chicago. But I think the energy, the inventiveness, the kind of savvy about doing it their way and not the old ways on so many levels is really quite thrilling. Of course, it was also thrilling, I think, last spring in Madison and, you know, kind of the massive immigration resistance and labor joining in to some extent now with Occupy and the prison rebellion. So, you know, it's funny. You look one day and you see quiet on the left. And then suddenly you look again and you see, you know, upsurge, upheaval, revolutionary energy, and transformation. It's very thrilling when you see it.
In our day, there was, of course, an international revolution going on. There was struggle all over the world. But it's interesting because there are international ties right now. In fact, much of the energy that's going on that happened in Madison and that's happening in New York and that's happening actually in places all over the country right now. Some of it's antecedent. Some of it really was started in Europe, in Greece, in France, and you know the Arab Spring. All of this kind of awakening all over the world. It's sort of an international movement.
I think it is, and I think we wouldn't see Occupy Wall Street without the Arab Spring. Maybe we would. You never know.
Yeah.
But so much of it seems to have taken its spirit and its energy from that incredible insurgency, you know, that involved young people and nonviolent resistance and was joined by labor and women's organizations and so many others. Certainly in Tunisia and in Egypt. I think when I was in Madison last spring, you know, and it was the struggle there was being led by teachers and nurses, really by women who were state employees and joined in bizarrely and thrillingly by state police and firefighters. They had signs all over, homemade signs about Tahrir West and, you know, modeling themselves explicitly after what was going on in the Mideast. So I do think this is, you know, having a contagious effect the way freedom always does. It really is contagious, and it makes people who might have been sleeping or slumbering or fearful suddenly find their voice and their comrades.
You know,
and,
it's
unbelievably interesting to see the challenge. And I think the Occupy Wall Street movement, really targeting the massive inequality, you know, by just naming that, by pointing at Wall Street, by the 99%, has created a very big tent, a very big umbrella. And so it's a little unlike our lists, you know, of all the various things that are going on, but it encompasses it.
That's funny, because that was the next thing I was going to ask you. It's by the 99%, it's by definition a very inclusive movement, an inclusive concept.
It is, and it's very... I don't know if you have one there. I'm assuming there's an Occupy in Austin.
Absolutely.
Always a hotbed.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they're very eager to have lessons, have conversations, have speakers. There's a brilliantly innovative thing going on in Chicago. Maybe it's in other places, too, where... there's a group of people who've named themselves Occupy the Hood, and primarily African-American and Latino young people from the south side and the near west side of Chicago, who are bringing them into the neighborhoods and doing a lot of back-and-forth teaching in a very collegial way, you know, rather than an accusatory way, kind of startlingly brilliant and beautiful.
It's interesting. We had on the 6th, we had what was estimated at between 1,200 and 1,500 people here for a big event. And there's been stuff happening continually. There's different things that are incorporating different constituencies into it. There's a big labor march Sunday. So yeah, there's been quite a bit of activity here. But I mean, there's virtually a city in the country, whatever size, it hasn't had some kind of activity, I think.
Exactly. I'll give you another example. There was a I don't know what it was. It was a teach-in last night called Follow the Money that was primarily organized by the unions. It had several, you know, political representatives from Congress and local leaders speak, as well as Iraqi and Afghan vets against the war led it off. But it was a teach-in about what's going on with the economy. And then the whole auditorium, you know, over 1,000 people, including Representative Jan Schakowsky and Jesse Jackson and so on, marched out down Michigan Avenue with our picket signs about jobs with justice and so on, and joined the young people from Occupy who were in that iconic place in Grant Park across from the Hilton underneath the statue of the horse. And they were having their general assembly. And we all sat down and they schooled everybody in how you do it, what the code words are and how votes are taken and how you express your approval and disapproval. It was so moving about, you know, kind of a very flexible but participatory democracy process, very open democracy process.
The concept, the way it's being done, the way the assemblies are being done, the kind of parallel or the horizontal sort of democracy that's going on, which in some ways has almost proven rigid, and they're learning. I mean, there's a whole learning process, and it's difficult for us, some of us, to stand back and say, oh, well, you know, we know how to do it. This is how you need to do it.
Right.
It's hard for us to resist that temptation, although it's okay because nobody's going to listen to us anyway.
So. Exactly right.
But
I think it's we have to remind ourselves, as we do with our children and grandchildren, that they're actually not asking for our advice, and when they want to, they will. So I think, you don't want to get, of course you don't want to get addicted to your tactics and confuse your tactics with something bigger, with your bigger strategy. But I feel so far the flexibility and the bounce back is quite dramatic. There were 175 people arrested in Grant Park last Saturday night here. And the General Assembly that we sat in on yesterday was contemplating whether to be back there this Saturday night, which they voted on.
I don't know if we established this, but you're in Chicago.
I am in Chicago.
Yeah. How's the weather up there, by
Everybody
the way?
Was in Chicago. Isn't this the center of the universe?
It probably is. We all are in the center of the universe.
Maybe not.
People in Austin really think they're in the center of the civilized universe, and it can be something of a problem, this sort of stuff. What's the weather?
It's dark now, and it is, it was raining yesterday, and I don't know, what will be next, any level, including the weather and the challenges of being.
Well, that is one thing that has been right.
I do feel that it's zesty and lively, and solutions will be found.
One thing that has been raised, I mean, the initial stage is always exciting, but now they're sleeping through the winter, staying, maintaining, growing, and there's going to be difficulties along the way, and certainly there's going to be problems with dealing with inclusion. There's going to be problems with how you deal with, say, the people who think the problem is the Federal Reserve, the Ron Paul types, and then the crazies that the media will tend to sort of focus on. All of that's a part of the process, and you can't just let it get you down. You just have to learn to do it, I guess.
Well, I think that a lot of the young people, as they were in Cairo, are avoiding a lot of our pitfalls, just to stay with the theme of not giving too much advice for the moment. Okay. So they really... they're really avoiding having spokespeople. The media insists on it. They seem to be good-humored and find it funny that the media, attempts first to ignore them and then to ridicule them. And I think now a lot of money seems to be going into demonizing them. And, I think that there's a, they seem to have a gyroscope that's knows who they are and maybe doesn't know where they're going, but knows where they're not going, and that's a lot.
Well, the other thing that the media is looking for, and that maybe liberal America or mainstream America even is looking for, is this whole concept of demands. And I was interviewed on a local news station, and one of the things that I said is movements. This is a movement. Movements don't have demands. Movements develop a critique of society and maybe have a vision for something better. And demands and specifics kind of evolve over time.
That's brilliant, Thorne. I like that, because a campaign might have demands, There's a campaign to get the U.S. out of Iraq, let's say. And, I think that's a necessary part of what's happening. I'm hoping that with the economic analysis of the greedy, greedy rich and the rest of us, we also look to the wars as a central point of this. But I think you're right that it is a movement primarily, and the analysis of, what's every generation has to name the moment in order to have a movement. Yes. So the by naming the moment as the as Occupy Wall Street,
right?
As we said before, a big umbrella under which to house a lot of agitation.
And it took us quite a while to get to a serious economic analysis of society, or to see that as being to put that at the fore, and they're doing that right out of the gate.
That's true.
Okay.
But you want to keep the global. We started, some of us, with the global,
right,
with the war and with the Black Freedom Movement, and that grounded us, I think, in our particular moment.
Yeah, and I think
you're right. It took a while to get to class analysis that accompanied that here and globally.
Right. Okay.
Ties are so deep and so good, I heard Naomi Klein speak the night I was there in New York, and she was wonderful. She harkened back to her organizing days around Seattle in 99 and the World Trade Organization. And I think that this is it's a movement, as you say, it also is one giant teach-in.
I thought that it was interesting. I saw read an article that she wrote about, of course, Naomi Klein got busted. In her cocktail dress, she was going to a Huffington Post cocktail party, and she ended up getting busted by the cops on her because she sort of started questioning what they were doing. We need to take a break. My guest is Bernadine Dorn. I'm Thorn Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We'll be right back.
We're in the middle of a revolution because I see the face of things to come. Oh, your Constitution, well, my friend, it's gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about destruction of all the evil it will have to end. I'm here to tell you about destruction of all the evil it will have to end.
Okay, I'm Thorn Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and we're talking with Bernadine Dorn. Bernadine, mostly what I want to talk about is what's going on now. I want to talk about what you've been doing and how you see things, and I really want to talk about your work, too, and work with as an advocate for children and so forth. I do feel a responsibility. When Bill was on our show, he actually said, I want to talk about Weatherman. You and Bill have both written in articles that we've run on the Rag blog about you've looking back, and Bill wrote about the fact that everybody's asking him to apologize and how complicated and complex a question that is. I don't want to dwell on this, but I want to ask you
I'm happy to talk about it. There's no secrets, as you know.
I know. So I guess the general question is, right now, what is, there were a whole lot of factors involved in those times, and I'm sure we all think that we made mistakes or somewhere along the line. I think we all did, but we also it's not a simple question. How do you feel right now about what went on? I mean, there's a lot of questions involved in that, but if you have to just put it in a few words,
sure. I'll try a few words.
or a few more.
I mainly feel that I was lucky to be born into revolutionary times and a time of agitation and upheaval. I think agitation lights up the truth, and it changed our lives. It knocked us off course, and I think most people from the broad upheaval of the 60s still try to live in harmony with our values. So that to me seems like just one of the luckiest and most fortunate things that ever happened. Of course you don't live to be 70 without regrets. Of course we all made mistakes. I'm happy to iterate some of them. I think our most dramatic mistakes were not be always fighting for the maximum amount of unity. I think that we lost the thread in a way about how we came into the movement. You know, at least somebody like me without any political background, fresh, raw, not having much of an analysis. And so it made it harder then for other people to walk in, to be invited in. So that notion of, that's why I'm emphasizing, I think, the big tent of now, because you must, as part of an upheaval, be able to invite in, maybe not 99%, but something pretty close. I think young people today are avoiding some of the mistakes we made about individual leadership and having spokespeople. I think not confusing tactics with the issues. I think that the way that we ended up talking about violence was a mistake. I don't really think what we did was that much of a mistake. I'm talking about the big we now. because we were in a kind of a revolutionary moment where, you know, in our name, almost 1,000 people a day were being killed in Vietnam for a 10-year period, U.S. and Vietnamese people, and black revolutionaries were being killed and assassinated and subverted and jailed right in front of our eyes. So there was an urgency to the, we all felt, I think, a sense of having to step up and step in and put our bodies on the line. But I think we got a little, and most of the direct action, almost all of the direct action that we did, I think, was against property.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, it's odd to me that some of us have become notorious for violence and for being the violent revolution. It's so bizarre, the level of violence coming from the U.S. government. And the movement here, even at its margins, did not take the course that was taken in Italy or Germany, for example, not to mention a lot of other parts of the world, but was remarkably restrained around the question of violence.
Yeah, I think that people have a misrepresentation of actually what the Weather Underground did, which was exclusively violence against property.
It's an interesting question. There was a lot of violence against property, beginning with, you know, burning draft cards and going in and pouring blood on draft files and breaking into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. So, much of the agitation that happened in the Black Freedom Movement and in the anti-war movement involved illegality. It involved breaking what were seen as illegal and unjust laws and being willing to take the consequence. And I think that goes under the big rubric of direct action, nonviolent direct action.
Okay, do you think that when we look at... All right, let's look tactically. Do you think that what Weather did was looking back, and it's always nice to have hindsight, was it a mistake? I'm not going to say, would you do the same thing again, because that's stupid. But, I mean, do you think that it was...
We made mistakes, of course, but as you said, so did everybody who did the other things. I mean, you know, all of our dear friends and comrades who went different ways at that moment in 1969, 1970, have their own mistakes, which they account for, too. Nobody knew exactly what to do. And I think, was it right to go into the factories? I think it was great. Was it right to create alternative institutions, you know, free schools and free clinics and midwifery and so on, communes? Yes, I think that was great. Was it right to join the Democratic Party and try to create an anti-war and progressive wing of the Democratic Party, an equality-driven progressive wing? Sure. In other words, I don't see what the it is that actually must have been done, except it's so clear to me that we should have been for more unity and embraced a variety of tactics and strategies. That's the part that I wish we could do again. In the details, I don't know, I still find it all ironic. Don't you think it's ironic that the calls all around the world are now called Days of Rage? In a way, that's right. One thing I wish we could have done differently, but there it is. Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
The calls for general strikes, the calls for mass demonstrations. So, yes, I would do, of course, would do it differently. But I find each step puzzling. With it, each step saying that opens more questions, because it isn't obvious, doesn't obviously reveal the yellow brick road.
Okay, you and Bill wrote in the rag blog or in the article we ran in the rag, you said eventually you came to think that we could make a revolution and that in any case it was our responsibility to try. In retrospect, and this is my last retrospect question.
That's all right. That's good.
Do you think that we had perhaps an overblown sense, at least, of what we were capable of doing?
Yes and no. I'm still, I guess, conflicted about it because, you know, one of the things that strangled the U.S. radical movement forever has been U.S. exceptionalism. All of this other stuff is fine for other parts of the world, but not here. But, of course, you know, dissent, once it's a powerful movement, is not tolerated here either. It's only tolerated when it's not a powerful movement. So I think the U.S. exceptionalism is a false idea. But I do think that we got self-righteous about having the correct way. So did everybody else. So, yes, I think we were wrong. We didn't live in a revolutionary moment. But did it seem like it was a revolutionary moment at that time, looking around the world and seeing Mexico in flames, you know, countries bordering the United States in flames, you know, agitation and all kinds of uprisings in Europe, not to mention Latin America and Africa and of course, Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. So it looked like revolution was possible, and we should go for it, because if you don't go for it, imagine that. You know, I try to both think how preposterous that was, and also to recognize that, to be honest about why we thought that and how we thought that and what was going on at the time.
The interview that Jonah did with you, which I really enjoyed a lot, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, it was a great interview.
There were a couple of comments on the Rag Blog to that interview, and a couple of people have accused Weatherman or said Weatherman was responsible for the destruction of SDS. And I think that's myself. I actually responded. I think that's silly. I think SDS was the victim of a whole convergence of factors, including the government's repression and COINTELPRO and sectarian organizations, all kinds of things, the generational burnout. There were a whole lot of factors involved with SDS's collapse. And I don't know if SDS really was structured in a way to be an ongoing radical student organization or left organization. But your reflection on the importance of SDS in its time, the role that it played, and do you think it could have been a continuing organization, and do you think such an organization is possible now?
Oh, the last one, I have no idea.
Yeah.
If it's possible now. I think we have the movement right now that we're having for a lot of good reasons, and SDS was with a headquarters and elected people, leaders, and so on. Maybe it's too cumbersome for now. But let's go back to your question about why SDS ended.
Okay.
For your meditation on it, I think.
Okay.
You know, and I know, that there's a whole effort by some SDSers to say, if only Weatherman hadn't come along, you know, and it was so perfect before, and it was particularly so perfect in the early years. I think most people have, on reflection, rejected that foolish idea. Most of the people who, you know, who advocate that, sort of crystallized around Todd Gitlin, I guess, you know, weren't around for the previous 2 or 3 years. SDS became a mass organization, really, in 68. I mean, it's over the summer of 68, the fall of 67, the summer of 68, you know, school opened that year, where SDS went from being a relatively small but powerful and influential organization to being a mass organization, to inventing chapters at community colleges and working class schools and high schools. And that presented a different set of contradictions. It just did. And so for a year and a half, it expanded, enormously. And then it was moved on by disciplined secret cadre organizations. That wasn't the Weatherman at the time. And a mass organization in that situation is really challenged. You didn't want to be anti-communist. You didn't want to push them out just because they were a disciplined cadre organization. But mass organizations can get taken over in that way quite easily. And we spent a year, when I was the one of the national secretaries of SDS, trying to debate and argue and organize and save SDS, I guess you'd say. And at the end of the day, I think it was not savable. Now, that's obviously self-serving, but I don't see how. And I think that the contradictions, the organization at the time that was trying to take it over had two key elements of its argument. One was that the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and the North Vietnamese were selling out the revolution. This is in 1969.
Right.
When bombing the dikes and bombing Hanoi and nuclear weapons are on the possibility planning stage for the U.S. military. When carpet bombing is the major strategy, and napalm and the rounding up of people into strategic hamlets. It was an outrageous position to denounce the Vietnamese instead of to denounce the United States that had 500,000 troops occupying a small country. And the second position, you know, was that the Black Panther Party was a despicable nationalist party. And their leadership was being assassinated. I thought, that was untenable. That wasn't part of the big tent. You couldn't have an anti-war, pro-equality mass organization that was denouncing the very people who were at the front lines of resisting U.S. power and U.S. aggression. I don't know what we should have done. I've certainly rethought it often. And maybe more experienced and more brilliant and more eloquent leadership might have held something together. But I don't think so. I think sometimes organizations, the organization itself, not the movement, as you say, has to be let go of and another form take over.
Well,
and in fact, it did take over. This is the irony of being so sentimental about SDS. You know, 4 months later, the United States nakedly invades Cambodia, which it had been doing already, and kills the students at Kent State and Jackson State, and a mass student organization springs up and shuts down campuses at hundreds of universities across the country. It isn't like it stopped the movement. It didn't stop the movement. It ended SDS.
Yeah, and SDS actually, I think, was more a movement than a front for a movement than it was an organization. There's a very interesting exhibit at the LBJ Library here right now. I think it's called Radical Groups Left and Right from the 60s or something like that. And there was a whole room on SDS, and actually it was pretty good. I mean, there were some original document support to your own statement there. A big quote from Carl Davidson across the top of the wall. It was pretty neat. And it was also the paper that we did at Chicago called Handwriting on the Wall. There were a couple of copies of that. And I said, oh, I did that. And somebody there said, oh, really? And we talked, and there were probably three people in the room who said they were involved with SDS in the 60s. Well, they weren't people who had membership cards.
Exactly. You know that the national meetings and the national council meetings and so on were a little bit like today in the sense that whoever showed up had the vote. And, the SDS voted against many national demonstrations, but then became a major force in those national demonstrations. So you're right. It was a movement. It was a big umbrella that a lot of people could take on. And, I think it is sad to see an organization go, and it's great that a couple of organizations have somehow weathered the times and still exist. I think of the National Lawyers Guild, which is where I came into political consciousness. But most haven't, and that's okay as long as you say, the movement and the spirit and the energy and the networks persevere. And they did revive as a student movement, within the year of SDS's demise.
Right. Okay. We'll have to say that SDS did play a remarkable historical
No question. And I think the willingness to go from a local critique of what our education was preparing us for and student rights to a broader critique of the war, to a step toward resistance and being willing to take an illegal stand about opposing the war and the draft, and then solidarity with the Black Freedom Movement. These were enormous steps, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were influenced by it.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Bernadine Dorn, and we'll be right back.
I support the death penalty.
I support the death penalty.
We will be prosperous if we embrace free trade.
Prosperity from free and fair trade.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. I did want to mention, by the way, that Tracy Schultz, who's normally my engineer and is my kind of co-producer, or whatever, is not here today, but Alan Campbell, my mentor at Co-op Radio, is here. Alan, thank you for engineering the show and for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Thorne.
Always a pleasure to have you. We're talking with Bernadine Dorn on Rag Radio, and Bernadine, you're a clinical professor of law. You were a founder of the Children and Family Justice Center. You've been involved in a variety of issues that you've advocated for. In terms of the criminal justice system, how important? What do you see happening? I mean, is it totally broken?
Well, it's broken. I don't know if it's totally broken. It's got some great principles underlying it, I think, of due process and equal protection. But I think that, we have a criminal justice system that in many ways, when you throw it up against a screen and look, you see that we've betrayed, kind of the promises of constitutional rights and certainly of human rights. And when you look at children, And I just find children, like the environment, just a great way to look at the world, because you're futuring, by definition. You're looking ahead. You're thinking about where we'll be in 10 years and 20 years and their lifetime, 50 years, with those two issues when you think about the planet and about children's rights. So for me, it's been an area that takes you everywhere. We've focused on children and crime and delinquency because there seems to be an addiction to caging children, particularly kids of color, in the United States. And it's so scandalous. Kids are arrested for the flimsiest of reasons, where if you're white and privileged or you live in a certain zip code, you would never be arrested. Perhaps you've followed the new consent decree in New York that is allegedly going to stop the police from continuing their practices of stop and frisk. But this means that in the last year in New York City, stopped 700,000 young people of color, primarily young men of color, and frisked them. And yes, they find a joint or two, and then they arrest them. If that were happening to white men, it would just be an uproar in New York. So I think, you see sometimes how the school-to-prison pipeline works, how kids in certain schools are now arrested on school grounds for absolutely nothing but attitude, nothing but everything adolescents are supposed to do. And then a whole set of consequences, school expulsion, arrest charges, stigmatization of being in the justice system, being held in detention in unspeakable, overcrowded conditions, just harms their future. It knocks them. You know how we were talking about the kind of way in which SDS, was a pool table that where the ball hit us and set us off course and changed our lives? This is the other kind that destroys options and possibilities.
Okay,
for
you,
so many kids.
Bill Ayers is involved. His passion and his work has been in the area of educational reform.
Right.
And so, what the two of you do, I mean, obviously we can't change the world in any one single area. We have to do it in a lot of areas together at the same time.
Right.
I guess maybe there's two questions when we talk about our young people is one, what kind of world have we left them? And two, how are we preparing them to deal with it?
Exactly.
I'm not sure what the question is there. But.
Exactly. Well, you know, the world we've left them, you know, we have to apologize for. I mean, from the degradation of the planet and to the economic future that they're looking at, to the massive debt they find themselves in, to the fact that, you know, 21% officially using the outrageously outmoded official statistics, 21% of children in the United States, in what was until the last 2 years the richest country in human history, live in poverty. And of course it is different if you're African American. It's 39.1%. If you're Latino, the newest figures out last week say that it's 66.1 million Hispanic children are living in poverty. That's up 36% from just 3 years ago. So some people and some families, and mainly the young, are being hardest hit here, not the old. Isn't that interesting? In this same period of 40 years, because of Social Security and pensions and retirement, old people, while being hurt, are being hurt less. And the burden of our multiple crises is falling on young people. So I just think it's outrageous, and that we have to, you know, put children first, that's a good slogan. It helps us think about our values and who we are and who they are. And I think children's voices, young people's voices, are essential. They're smart, they're savvy, they're more global than we were. They have a sense of what their own experience is, and if we listen to them, we would be thrown into action. That's what I think.
And they know how to use a cell phone.
Our current project is to close juvenile prisons.
Yeah,
most of them, maybe almost all of them, to change sentencing of kids, to stop criminalizing normal youth behavior, and to recognize that adolescents are kind of fearless about speaking truth.
Okay, our criminal justice system, can we seriously reform it without ending the drug war? And two, can we end the drug war without dealing somehow with the whole kind of superstructure that's been created around our prisons and especially around
the drug war? Well, we're in an ironic moment, aren't we? Because states can't afford the prisons to keep going, the prisons that they built and that they're paying for in terms of the employment and so on. So I think it's a strange moment. Yes, we have to end the drug war. I don't think that'll be simple, but I think we're already well along the way to decriminalizing marijuana. And I think that's why these changing the stop and frisk policies in New York are so important, that we make that a wave that goes across the country and stop the police from doing it everywhere. It's so discriminatory and it's so outrageous. It has nothing to do with public safety or health. I think you're right about that. The bigger drug war is something that we have to puncture. It hasn't made us safer. It hasn't stopped one bit. It's militarized us at home, the whole national security apparatus that's insane. It's militarized important parts of Latin America with no change in production. So, yeah, I think governors, all kinds of governors, are shutting down prisons and reducing prison populations because it's not sustainable. So I think it's our job to make that not just an economic reality, but to give it the human dimension and to jump on. And realize that you can sanction misbehavior in all kinds of ways other than prisons. We're somehow trapped in this ridiculous idea that we need prisons to be safe. We were persuaded of that in the early 90s by a very orchestrated campaign, but it's not true.
Okay, we look at the world and we acknowledge that the U.S. empire is in decline, and yet we continue to expand our military into all over the world. We spend incredible amounts of money on our foreign adventures, and we don't, and yet we're cutting back on education and health and human services. There's a contradiction there that has to be dealt with.
Well, I think, you know, we'll see how it emerges. I think we, all of us, have to demand. It appears that the Obama administration is now committed to pretty complete withdrawal from Iraq. And you look at the Iraq debacle, you know, the millions of lives lost, the ethnic cleansing that the United States did in Iraq, the direct cost of the war, $800 billion, and then if you add veteran care and future expenses, it's $6 trillion. And it's just, it's a such an abomination. So I want us all to go out and work with the Iraqi and Afghan vets against the war, who I think are the most powerful voices here, but also to demand an end to it. The United States, just was reading, they built, you know, the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is 80 football fields.
Yeah.
80,
yeah.
Not 8, 80 football fields. I mean, what is going on here, you know? And yet, how many of us know that the Iraqi parliament just rejected two things the U.S. wanted to get out of Iraq? One was, and this is kind of a puppet parliament, they rejected the idea of U.S. leaving a residual force. So apparently not, except maybe private contractors and the CIA, but mainly not. And they rejected the U.S. demand for immunity for war crimes committed there.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, really.
That the Iraqi parliament rejected those demands?
Yeah.
So now we need to do that with Afghanistan. We need to have hands-off Pakistan. Obviously, the U.S. is saber-rattling about Pakistan. We need to say, no, not Iran. You're not going to put Iran on the agenda here because there's an election campaign and somebody wants to get elected. So I think the peace movement, the peace part, the demand that the U.S. get out of the world and that we learn to live differently so that others may live, is part of, you know, the declining empire, but we must get the military boot of the United States off of the world.
Okay.
Part of learning to be 6% of the world's people.
In about 2 minutes here, we're running down, and this is just quickly.
That would go fast.
We've actually got 5 minutes left, but just quickly, progressive politics, the Democratic Party, electoral politics, the Obama administration, which of course is, I think, acknowledged to have been a Bill Ayers conspiracy. So many people have, you know, the Obama campaign pulled hundreds of thousands of young people out into the electoral system, and many of those people, there was a theory that we'd lost those people because they became so disillusioned with Obama, but here they are back in the streets again. But it's a very complex, it's easy to just criticize Obama, but it's a very complex situation. And what do you think about, quickly, the Obama administration, what he's done and what we can do and what we have to do next and so forth? Do we?
Well, the Obama administration, like any administration, will be as good as we demand it. I think that Howard Zinn, you know, had it right about agitators and activists and outsiders, extremists and troublemakers lighting up the truth. Agitation, you know, is what we need. And he makes a very strong argument. Of course, he's talking about JFK in 1962 and 3. But it's the same argument as today. Politicians do what politicians do. And our job is to demand peace, economic justice, environmental integrity, acting immediately to stop the fossil fuel nightmare. That's our job. And politicians will be better than they've been, not just the last 3 years, but the last 30 years, 40 years, if we have those movements in place. I think all of our energy should go toward building those movements. It will make, of course, we should vote then.
The only real force from the populace for a while has really been the Tea Party has come from, and the evangelical religious right, and so that's been where the pressure has been coming on the politicians. Do you think that
the Occupy middle of whatever we create, and if right. we create a far right, of course it's amplified by money enormously beyond what it actually is, but. If we have a social justice movement and a peace movement and an economic justice movement, environmental justice movement, if we have that as a popular force that can imagine another world, we have to learn to live differently. The United States cannot go on pretending to live this way without the 99 and the 1%, and that's what we see. So the only way out for us, I think, is to, of course, I think, revolutionary upheaval, but to build these social movements that will make politicians act better.
Do you see what's happening right now on the streets with the Occupy Wall Street movement and Madison and all that larger picture? Do you see that as even though there's really very little similarity in terms of content and substance, do you see that as being a counterbalance to that Tea Party right?
I think it's a radical reimagining of a world based on justice. I don't really compare it at all to the right wing, which is highly financed and top down and hierarchical. I think that this is a people's movement, and of course, a lot of American people are taken by ideas of individuality, rugged individuality, and may go for certain ideas. We have to argue about those ideas.
Down to 30 seconds. Sum it up. What can people do?
And most people want meaningful work, not just any job. And most people want justice. So I think that we're on the side of the majority of the American people. We shouldn't worry about the Tea Party. We should build our movement robustly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bernadine Dorn. This has been fun and enlightening. It's been great talking with you, and we'll do it again sometime.
And it's wonderful to hear your voice. I love your program and your work in Austin, and I hope I get to see you soon.
Okay, great. We will.
Good.
Charlie Fay, next week, singer-songwriter, community activist. If you want to learn, go to theragblog.blogspot.com to see Jonah Raskin's interview with Bernadine Dorn. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.